Tomorrow is a very special day in the Jewish calendar. It is, what's tomorrow? Pesach Sheni. Tomorrow is Pesach Sheni. Pesach Sheni is a day of, one could say, how much religious significance does Pesach Sheni have nowadays? Anyone want to venture a comment or guess?
I'm going to say something close to zero.
Exactly zero. Pesach Sheni is only significant in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, that it's when people, individuals who could not participate in the original Korban Pesach in Chodesh Nisan because either they were tummy, they were ritually impure, they were too far away, they didn't manage to make it in time, they were allowed to do a makeup Korban Pesach 1 month later. But that's the only significance. If there was no original Korban Pesach, then there's no Pesach Sheni. So now when there's no Beis HaMikdash, no possibility of offering the Korban Pesach, perhaps there is a possibility of offering the Korban Pesach, and without the Beis HaMikdash, we're not going to get into that right now. But in any event, the Korban Pesach was not offered during Nisan, so there is no Pesach Sheni. There's no Pesach Sheni at all. That's why the Ashkenazi minag really is that we even say Tachanun on the Pesach Sheni, because there's absolutely no religious significance in the day of Pesach Sheni nowadays. Nowadays at all. However, Sephardim, and this branched over to Hasidim, and then to other groups of Ashkenazim who were very gung-ho about trying to skip Tachan at every opportunity. So the Sephardi minag is that that they do not say Tachan on Pesach Sheni, because it's a Zecher LeMikdash, that we want to remember the fact that in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, in the times of the Korban Pesach, there was significance to the idea of Pesach Sheni, which would take place on the 14th of Iyar. Both minhagim are legitimate, but fundamentally the Ashkenazi minhag is that we do say Tachanun, because nowadays there really just is no say religious significance as well, which is the same reason that the Ashkenazi minhag is to say Tachanun immediately starting after Shavuos, starting 2 days after Shavuos, after Isruch Hag, because there's no religious significance the 7 days after Shavuos, which is when, in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, people could bring makeup korbanos that they couldn't bring on Shavuos, and they wanted to bring the Shalmei Simcha, the quasi-voluntary korban that brought extra happiness and joy by eating its meat on Yantif. So they used to bring it in the week following Shavuos. But nowadays, no religious significance of the week following Shavuos at all, which is the same machlokas. That the Sephardim do not say Tachanun the week after Shavuos, because it's to make a remembrance to the times of the Beis HaMikdash. And Ashkenazim, originally, do say Tachanun during the week after Shavuos. So we have the same idea of Pesach Sheni. And there's also practice that some people have that sort of cropped up in the last recent time frame, which is that some people eat matzah on Pesach Sheni, on the 14th of Iyar. So the poskim point out that, first of all, we don't find Indian to eat just plain matzah on Pesach Sheni at all. And even if you want to say that there's some cute thing to eat matzah as a remembrance of what was done during Pesach Sheni, when they used to eat matzah with a korban Pesach Sheni, when was that done? When was the matzah that accompanied the Pesach Sheni eaten? That was eaten on the night of the 15th of Iyar, just like the regular korban Pesach, even though it was sacrificed on the 14th of Nisan, it was eaten on Seder night, on the night of the 15th of Nisan. So too, the Pesach Sheni was eaten with the matzah on the night of the 15th of Iyar. So if anything, you should eat the matzah tomorrow night and not during the day on the 14th of Iyar, which is when most people who have this idea of eating matzah on Pesach Sheni will be eating it anyway. So again, our minhag really is that we do not eat matzah. We can't. If you like matzah, by all means, eat matzah on Pesach Sheni. But to make a point of eating matzah on Pesach Sheni is not really our practice to do so. I probably will eat matzah because I have a ton of matzah left over. I've been making emotzi on matzah every Shabbos since Pesach, though. I have so much left over. But to make a point to do it, that we don't do. But even though the Pesach Sheni doesn't really have religious significance nowadays, it still has much to teach us in terms of the lessons involved therein. Pesach Sheni was not given, the mitzvah Pesach Sheni was not given from on high. Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, all of a sudden out of the blue, God says, you know, if somebody forgot Pesach, the first Pesach, Or I'm getting a message. My internet connection is unstable. Is anybody having issues hearing me?
A little bit here and there, but you're generally clear.
Okay. That God didn't just say, if you have issues making it to Pesach Rishon, so you can make Pesach Rishon. It was done in response to a request that there were people who were Tameh, and they were devastated at not being able to participate in the first Pesach, and they petitioned Moshe for a second chance. So where else in the Torah do we have such a thing? You weren't able to do a mitzvah, so you lost out. That's it. You don't get a makeup. So you were honest. You couldn't do it, so you couldn't do it. You don't get penalized for being totally prevented from doing it due to circumstances not under your control. But nevertheless, here there was God gave an opportunity to make up the mitzvah for Pesach Sheni if you didn't make it to the first main event of Pesach. So the reason is that God was apparently responding to their feeling of intense emotional distress and not having been able to participate in the mitzvah, and that's what God looked on so favorably that he gave a new mitzvah allowed to make up the Korban Pesach a month later. So Rabosai, we're dealing with these same emotions nowadays, that where we lack mitzvahs, we lack shul, and we have to think about how we think about it. That all the mitzvahs, tefillah, betzibur, are listening to the Kriya Satorah that we can't participate in, again, through no fault of our own, that we're not going to be penalized in Shemayim for failing to hear Kriya Satorah for the last several weeks. We're doing what we have to do. We're not allowed to hear Kriya Satorah because of that's what the medical professionals have instructed us, that we shouldn't be in shul now. So we have to fulfill the Torah's dictum of the Chayvahem, that we have to live with the mitzvahs, that when there's a situation of pikuach nefesh, that sets aside almost all the mitzvahs in the Torah. So we're doing what we need to do, but we have to have the feeling that we miss it, and that the feeling that we miss it and that we're emotionally distraught not being able to do it is something that we have to cultivate, and hopefully that part of that feeling is part of what will constitute the zechusim, the merits that will encourage Kadosh Baruch Hu to bring an end to the current situation and to be able to fulfill more mitzvos in their proper way without the specter of illness hanging over us. Okay, so that's Pesach Sheni, and now we're going to start discussing a little bit about the Parshas Emor. So Parshas Emor, I was asked to give references to anything from the Parsha. So Parshas Emor begins in Leviticus chapter 21, beginning of chapter 21. And Parshas Emor, like last week, Kedoshim is chock full of mitzvahs. So there's no way we can cover anything close to everything contained in this week's Parsha. But we're going to try to cover some topics of mitzvahs that are mentioned in Parshas Emor. So the first thing that's mentioned in the Parsha is the rule regarding the Tumah of Kohanim. So I do not believe we have any Kohanim participating in the Shir today. But we know that there is a rule that Kohanim are not allowed to become Tumah. They're not allowed to come into contact with a dead body in a way that would render them ritually impure. Even nowadays, that everyone's ritually impure anyway, and that it's not necessarily going to add an additional level of actual tumah to you, that you were tameh and you're going to stay tameh. Nevertheless, kohanim are still not allowed to enter the same room as a dead body. They're not allowed to touch a dead body. They're not allowed to carry a dead body, etc., etc. But there are some exceptions to this rule, that the kohen is allowed to come into contact with a dead body, and according to many opinions, is even required to come into contact with a dead body. Not doesn't mean you have to actually touch the body, but carry it or be in the same room with it, whatever, when a close relative of the Kohen dies and he's taking care of the funeral arrangements, then the Kohen is allowed or required to become Tameh due to being in proximity to the dead body. So according to some Rishonim, this is actually the Gaonim write this way, actually, that this is the source in the Torah for the general mitzvah of Avelus. that to perform the halachos that of mourning when called for. So again, we hope this is not shayach to any one of us in practical terms for a very long time. But it's important to have at least a basic outline of understanding of these rules, because when it actually comes time to observe them, then people are obviously in a very fraught emotional state, and they're not always in a position to start opening up books and learning all the halacha. So it's important to have at least a basic knowledge of the rules of Avelus, the rules of mourning, so that people will at least know how to start acting and how to ask questions and shilas when the Avelus arises. So the meaning, these Rishonim understand, the ones who hold that this is the source in the Torah for the requirement of Avelus, hold that what the Torah means when it says that the Kohen is allowed to come into contact with his relatives who died, it means that this is an outgrowth of the general requirement that Jewish people are required to mourn for close relatives. So based on that, since there, this is a direct outgrowth of the requirement of Avelus, so let's look at which relations are mentioned in the parsha. So we have, again, this is in Pasuk Beis, this is Leviticus chapter 21, verse 2. Kim li she'ero akarov ilav only applies to close to relatives. There are drushes about whether she'er is referring maybe to a wife, the Gemara talks about, okay? But the simple reading of the pasuk is not talking about a wife. Li imo ulaviv, one's mother and father, velivno ulvito ulachiv, and to your son and daughter and brother. But by a sister, you have a caveat. The life also have that when it comes to a sister, one is the Kohen is only allowed to participate in the funeral to the full extent. I mean, obviously, he can stand outside the room, whatever, if it doesn't involve becoming tummy, but he's only allowed to participate to the full extent if it's an unmarried sister, a sister who's never been married. So according to these Rishonim, on a Deoraisa level, these are the only relations that one is required to mourn for, that the other type of relationships, meaning what other types of people do we know that practically you have to do Avelos for, besides the ones mentioned explicitly here. So any brother or sister. That we know we do Avelos for any brother or sister, and even a half brother or sister. Chazal assumed that when the pasuk says here a brother and sister, it's referring to paternal siblings that share the same father. But we know that practically speaking, we have to do avelos for any sibling, and also spouses. Again, spouses are not mentioned explicitly here, but one is required to do avelos for spouses, and in fact, the kohen is even allowed to become tamei to bury his wife. Because even though according to simple reading, it's that wife is not mentioned here. Nevertheless, since the general requirement of burial for a wife falls on the husband, so we're afraid that if where the Kohen is not allowed to bury his wife, then no one will want to bury her. They'll say, no, it's your responsibility, you're the husband. So therefore, that makes the wife sort of like a meis mitzvah. That we know another exception to the rule that the Kohen's not allowed to become tamei to a dead body is when there's a meis mitzvah, when there is a dead body that's just lying around when there's no one to bury it, and the Kohen is allowed to bury that dead body as well. So they say that one's wife is no worse than a meis mitzvah because no one else is going to want to bury her if she dies. Okay, so that's the sheet of... Gaonim, the Rif, the Rambam. The Rambam is a little bit of a knach on the sister business, but I don't want to go into that now. That midoraisa, it's you have to only mourn for the relatives that are mentioned explicitly in the verses, and midarabanan for any sibling and any spouse. Okay. The other caveat, according to this opinion, that holds that mourning is deoraisa, because the rule of the Kohen becoming tummy is merely an extension thereof, The other caveat is that according to the Shita, the only thing that's deraisa is one day of mourning. And not only is it any one day of mourning, it has to be that the person died and is buried on the same day. That's the deraisa of mourning. So if someone dies on Monday, it is not going to be buried till Tuesday. So according to these opinions, there's no avelos on a Torah level at all. And the avelos with the entire institution of the avelos would only be of rabbinic nature. Okay, so that's the one opinion. The second opinion is perhaps is the majority opinion of the Rishonim even, although we do have some weighty opinions on the first side that I mentioned, is that no. The laws of the for whom the Kohen is allowed to become Tamei have nothing to do with Avelos, have nothing to do with mourning. So therefore, most Rishonim actually hold that the entire institution of Avelos is completely Derabanan, is only of a rabbinic nature. And that explains a lot of things, and the fact that there's this rule in the Gemara that when you have various opinions in the Gemara about the laws of Avelos, so we tend to follow the lenient one. So if Avelos is always the Rabbanan, so that makes sense. Again, there are proofs for both sides, but fundamentally, we accept the opinion, really, at least Ashkenazim, accept the opinion that the entirety of Avelos is only the Rabbanan, which may have certain ramifications, that even if a person dies and is buried on the same day, then according to that opinion, it would only be the Rabbanan, and there we could be more lenient about certain rules. So again, just to go over that, again, one opinion the Rishonim holds that the one day of Avelos is Deraisa if it's the day of burial and death. And the other opinion in the Rishonim holds that the entire institution of Avelos is only of rabbinic origin, is only the Rabbanan. Again, that does not mean that we shouldn't take it seriously, but it occurs, but just has technical ramifications for certain aspects of the halachas. Unfortunately, in these times, we're experiencing in Klal Yisrael many deaths because of the coronavirus, including of some very prominent individuals. So the laws of Avelos are unfortunately more on everyone's mind than perhaps in normal times. One, there are a few shailas that are unique to actually the coronavirus crisis. One is that there is a different institution that precedes Avelos, which is called Aninus. The status of being an Onain is what the person is called who is subject to the status. That when a person the people who are required to mourn for him or her enter the status of aninos, which is means they're not, they haven't started shiva yet, but their whole task is to be focused on ensuring that the person receive a proper burial. So the aninos stage is a very weird, in limbo type of stage of halacha, where you're exempt from all the mitzvahs. You don't daven. You don't say Shema, you're not allowed to eat meat, you're not allowed to drink wine, and according to many opinions, and the Minhag follows this, one does not even make a brachis, one does not make a bracha when eating or drinking, because of two ideas. One is that since you're so involved busily in the preparations for the burial, so ha'osik b'mitzvah pater min ha'mitzvah, that when one mitzvah so totally that you're exempt from performing other mitzvahs. Another is that it's because of the honor of the dead person that it's inappropriate for the relative to be engaged in normal life. So therefore, you have these restrictions of aninos before the mourning period of Shiva officially begins. Like I said, you don't wear tefillin, you don't daven, etc. So the question, there's a very old machlokas regarding the shaila of What if you are not really involved in the burial preparations at all? What if you call up the Chevra Kedisha, you say, hey, my relative just died, please take care of the preparations for the burial. And let's say you're not involved in preparing eulogy. You're totally, absolutely have nothing to do with the burial. And you're just going to show up to the funeral. Is that a state of aninus or not? So the Gemara says that nimsar lakatofim, if the dead body is given over to the pallbearers, so you no longer have the status of an onin. The question is, does a Chevra Kadisha have this status? And if you give over the body to the Chevra Kadisha, are you no longer an onin? And therefore, you would have to daven, and you would have to make brachis, and you would be allowed to eat meat, etc. Okay, abstaining from meat and wine is not such a big deal. Well, you know, but regarding the brachis on the food, so you have a serious problem that you can't be machmir in both directions because either you're allowed to daven or you're not allowed to daven. And there are risha shittas to actually hold that you it's voluntary, but we don't assume that. So either you have to or you're not allowed. So especially with the coronavirus business, a lot of people were not leaving their homes at all. They had a relative who died, and obviously they were not at all involved in the preparations for the funeral, one iota, nothing. So therefore, the simple understanding would be that that person would not be subject to the rules of aninus. And this sometimes comes up in other cases as well, that people are totally no longer involved in the preparations for the burial, then the Anita status stops, and they would be required now to daven and make brachas on their food, etc. But if this ever comes up for anyone, so it's important to discuss it with a competent authority, because there are many different details that that will play into how one would answer this the shaila. That's question number one. Another major question that was going on with the coronavirus is, then normally, when does the Shiva start? When does the Avelus begin? Who knows?
Burial.
The burial. That's correct. That normally, when you go to the funeral you were at the burial, so that's when the Avelus starts, when you finish covering the coffin with earth. But what happens for people who are not going to the burial? How do you, what do you do? When does Avelus start? The Gemara says that if the dead body is being taken to a faraway place, so let's say you you worked hard on preparing the body for burial, and then you put him on a wagon, and he's being taken two towns over. This is nowadays, sometimes bodies are flown on airplanes, there at Yisrael or elsewhere, and you're not planning on attending the funeral. So when does the Avela start? Who knows?
When you surrender the body to the airline or what have you.
Correct.
Have control.
Yeah, so the way the Gemara describes it is when the mourner turns their face away. In other words, you load the body on the plane and then you leave to go home and you're no longer involved in the burial at all. So then you begin Shiva even though the body has not been buried yet. So what happens if you're not involved in the burial at all? You're staying home because of coronavirus. And now we have telephones and you live in New York and a relative dies in Los Angeles, and people could text you when the burial happens, but you're not going to the, you have no relevance over here. Does that, do you go by when the burial happens, or because you didn't actually do anything, you're not involved in the death physically at all, and you didn't turn your face away, you didn't give the body over to someone else, do you wait for that text from Los Angeles to begin sitting Shiva? So what do you think? Who has an answer? Who wants to venture a guess?
What if you're watching the whole thing on Skype or Zoom? The funeral.
Wow. Similar, I guess that would be similar to a telephone. You want to make an argument that it's considered more intimately present than participating in the funeral if you do it over Skype or Zoom? It's interesting. It's an interesting question. That's very fascinating, but I would assume since you're not physically there and it's in a different city, I'm talking about if it's in a different city. If you're in New York and it's like right here, and ordinarily you would for sure be going to the funeral, then you wait till the burial. That's not a question. But if it's far away and you wouldn't ordinarily be going to the burial, so when do you start counting the Shiva? So this is a machlokes famously between the Netziv, the last Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, who led one of the main leaders of Lithuanian Jewry in the 19th century, and his son-in-law, Reb Rafael Shapiro. So the Netziv held that you go in accordance with where the burial is, that you have to wait till you get the text from Los Angeles to begin sitting Shiva. And his son-in-law, Reb Rafael Shapiro, said, no, you have no, why would you do that? You're completely, it's as if from afar, even though you weren't involved in the burial directly, it's as if you turned your face away, like the Gemara says. You have no intentions on going to the burial. It's a very far away. You wouldn't even have gone under normal circumstances. So you start sitting Shiva immediately when you hear about the death. There is no aninos. You just start sitting Shiva immediately. So the normal practice, again, we're not going to go through all the proofs for both opinions, but the normal practice in is accordance with the latter way that you begin sitting Shiva immediately. So again, I hope this is irrelevant for anyone for a very long time. But should this happen that you're not accompanying the body at all, but some relative dies in a faraway city, and the burial is not going to be immediately, then one starts sitting Shiva right away. That's the normal. Okay. So the next pasuk. Now we're in pasuk Dalet, which is grammatically very interesting and unusual. Lo yitama baal be'amav, a master should not become impure in his nation, lehechalo, to become desanctified, to become, in other words, to become profaned. What does this mean? It's a very cryptic pasuk. And we have different interpretations of it. So Rashi says, he brings the drasha that's in terms of the way the Chazal ruled the halacha, which is that you sort of jumble all the words of the verse. That lo yama baal we're taking here not as master, but rather as husband. So a husband should not become tamei to become profaned. So Chazal interpreted as meaning that if the Kohen is married to a woman that he's not allowed to be married to, so for example, a woman who was previously divorced, so then he does not become Tamei when she dies. He's not allowed to become Tamei when dealing with her burial procedures. So that's not necessarily the simple meaning of the verse. The Rashbam interprets it, and he always focuses on the literal meaning of the verses, that he interprets it in the exact opposite way of the halacha, which is funny, a little bit interesting. They think that this verse is saying that a husband should not become tamei to his wife at all, which is again not the halacha. Unless you say that that's the literal meaning of the verse, and then the meis mitzvah business, because she's not going to have anyone else to bury her, overrides it. Which is again, that's how he understands it. Also, the Rasag, or Sajigon, in his literal interpretation, he interprets it to mean that Baal Be'amav is referring to the person to whom he is tummy, who he's thinking of becoming tummy for. So meaning, if there's a master, like a really great person, like, you know, the Gadol Hador dies. So you might think that a Kohen should be allowed to participate fully in the funeral. So the answer is, as the Pasuk, according to Rasag, that that is not permissible. That's obvious. That certainly is the halacha, that the Kohen is not allowed to participate in the funeral. I'll give an additional level of interpretation. Maseches Smaches, I believe. Maybe it's in the Torah's Kohanim also. I forget the exact source. But Chazal give an additional level of interpretation when it uses the word be'amav over here. That means that the person for whom one mourns in general is only someone who acts in a Jewish way. But if someone is poresh midarkei tzibur, which is the language of Chazal, if someone ceases to act in the manner of a Jew, one does not do avelus. One does not have to observe the laws of avelus. So what categorizes someone as poresh midarkei tzibur, as someone who does not observe, that who does not fit into the Jewish people? It's a very difficult question. It's a very, very difficult question, and one that there's not a clear-cut answer for. If somebody converts to another religion, God forbid, then that would be certainly an example of that. That one would not be allowed to do avelus for someone who converts to another religion. But there's a lot of somebody who's just an occasional sinner, you are required to do avelus for. So what's considered poresh midarkei tzibur? So is anyone who's not from poresh midarkei tzibur, who's systematically not from poresh midarkei tzibur, you don't have to mourn for such a person. So it's not so clear. But the general assumption nowadays is that, again, whether this applies in other areas of Zavalacha is a very long discussion, but that most of people nowadays, Jews who are not observant, are what we call tinok shenishba. They're so ignorant of Jewish laws and culture and the traditions, and they weren't steeped in the values that were instilled to them by their parents and left. They just never got on the boat. Their parents have already been gone for many generations from Judaism, Torah Judaism. So so the general practice is that one does mourn even for not frum relatives unless they're really not on the bandwagon. That if they do things that even are not considered minimal gestures of participation with the Jewish people, like, again, there's not a psak here if this is shayach to anyone, so again, it would be something to discuss privately. But poskim give different examples that if somebody doesn't even go to shul, doesn't observe Yom Kippur, doesn't go to shul, just that they can't be bothered with it. So that's considered by most Jews attending shul on Yom Kippur or fasting on Yom Kippur is sort of like a basic signifier of participation with Jewish life. So if somebody doesn't even do that, then one would not mourn for such a person. Again, I'm not paskening, but that's one suggestion that the poskim have given. Another issue that's come up, that if somebody chooses to be cremated, that we know that cremation, again, in normative Jewish thought, cremation is completely antithetical to all Jewish beliefs about what one's supposed to do after a person has died. And even people who are not from, generally, or at least used to, I don't know about nowadays, have this gut feeling that it's nishkan yiddish zach, that not something that a Jew does to get cremated. So somebody who anyway, you know, chooses to be cremated, so that's possibly an indication that the person is not to be mourned for.
What if they want to be buried in a mausoleum? Above ground burial.
That's not as bad as cremation. Jewish burial customs have have gone undergone some metamorphoses over the years. We know in the times of Chazal, they didn't just bury people directly in the ground. They used to bury people in caves and let the flesh decompose. And then when it was just bones left, they used to bury the bones.
Wow.
So that's, again, normative Jewish practice nowadays is not like that. You just bury people straight in the ground. Again, so a burial in a mausoleum is not accepted in contemporary Jewish practice, but since it doesn't involve active desecration of the body, I'm not saying anything lemaisa right now, but I would assume that that would not constitute porish midarkei tzibur, and one would still be encouraged to mourn for such a person. Again, different poskim have different standards. It also depends on one's relationship with a person. You know, that's why also if some people who commit such grievous sins so that they can't be considered part of Klal Yisrael, so again, even if it was only to one, it was sort of subjective to one person. So that's why there's a lot of discussion nowadays, unfortunately, that what about mourning an abusive relative? You know, it's obviously a horrible aveira, a horrible sin, a horrible thing that occurred. But the question is, and people, you know, when such a person dies, so the person who was abused, who might be a relative who would normally be required to mourn for that person, might not be so sad that the person died. So the general psak, again, if this, I hope this doesn't apply to anyone, but if it does, then there's room to discuss the possibility of not observing the laws of Avelos for an abusive relative. Again, any type, there are different types of abuse that, you know, might depend on which type it was. And how, if the person who's now potentially required to mourn could handle it or not handle it. There are a lot of subjective emotional factors when it comes to the laws of Avelos that we can't give every scenario in a shiur on the matter, but people should know when to ask a question. This actually comes up in a halachic discussion that we know that a spouse, you're required to mourn for a spouse. So what happens if the couple was ABG, all but get? They had decided to get divorced already. They didn't like each other. They were separated. They're just not halachically divorced yet. So are they still, if one of them dies, is the remaining one required to do avelos? That's also a big shaila. That we intuitively we'd want to say no, and many poskim do say no, but others say that no, there's a halachic relationship over here between the husband and the wife of a marriage. So until that's dissolved, they're still under the category of avelos. That they have to do avelos. That intuitively that strikes one as very not right. I think normally
on a couple of levels. One for putting the person in the position of you know, going through the actions of the motions of mourning someone that they don't care to mourn, and the other is it could actually turn in, if depending on how bad the relationship was, it could potentially turn into a week of secret celebration, which is not cover the mace.
I hear you. That's why I think I would be inclined in such a situation to say they shouldn't do avelos. But it's not such a pasha chayla is the main point I'm trying to bring out about this. And that there is some subjectivity, and if the whole institution, warning for a spouse is derabanan, and the whole institution of avelos might be derabanan, so there's more wiggle room than if there would be a component to it. Mm-hmm. But when you have a parent who one has a bad relationship with, again, there's a difference between a bad relationship and real abuse. But again, it's a very subjective thing. It should be discussed on a if such a thing comes up, it should be discussed on a an individual level. Okay,
So the parsha continues. Let's see, pasuk zayin. He's talking about a kohen.
Oh, talking about, just back to your point about turning into a week of celebration. So it actually is explicit that when someone dies who's really Porish Midarkei Tzibur, I'm not talking about somebody who's just not from, that maybe potentially one could get a psak under certain situations that they don't have to observe avelos for such a person. But if there's someone who's really just a wicked person who dies, then it says the opposite. You're not supposed to mourn, you're supposed to have a celebration. It says instead of wearing black clothes of avelos, you're supposed to wear white clothes and you're supposed to drink and have a joyous feast of celebration. So again, we're not talking about ordinary people who don't live up to our standards. We're talking about people who are really wicked. We're not talking about, you know, people who are not observant nowadays. We would be talking maybe about the founders of the Reform movement in early 19th century Germany, people who really actively tried to undermine the religious Misora of Klal Yisrael and were the instigators of it. Then if they had a relative who was supposed to mourn for them, a close relative, then the appropriate response to that person's death would have probably been celebration. As again, very subjective, would have to discuss each individual case, but would probably have been celebration rather than mourning.
Okay, fine. Pasuk Zion.
The pasuk says about a kohen, there are a few interesting things that Chazal derive from this pasuk, that a kohen is not allowed to marry a zona. So what's a zona? What's a zona, Nu? A harlot. So what's a harlot? So there are two different opinions in the Tanoim regarding what is meant by this pasuk of what is meant by this word of zona. So according to one of the Tanoim, it means just that, a woman who is completely promiscuous and sells her body, so she's not allowed to marry a kohen. So that's what we would assume by reading the pasuk, that that's what it means, right? So that opinion is actually not accepted lahalacha. That we accept the opinion of the other Tanoim, who hold that zona in this instance has a technical definition. That zona means a woman who has had relations with a man whom she is not permitted to be with. So what do I mean? If a woman engages in an incestual relationship, she will be not allowed to marry a kohen. Or if a woman has been with a non-Jew, for example. Since there's no permissibility of her ever having intercourse with a non-Jew, so she's not allowed to marry a kohen. This is a very big problem, actually, in nowadays for Bali Tshuva, especially. I mean, there could be FFP people who make mistakes also, but let's say there's a Jewish girl who goes to secular college, and sometime during the course of her secular college, she wants to become frum. And she's chozer b'tshuva. So then a couple of years down the road, she meets a nice guy, a nice from guy, and he happens to be a kohen. So that creates a major problem, because if it's generally assumed that most non-Orthodox young women who attend secular college are probably, Jewish women will probably have had relations with a non-Jew at some point, and maybe there are some who didn't. I'm not saying everyone. Years ago, this might not have been the case, but nowadays, it probably is the case. So there is an issue with potentially with someone in this type of situation marrying a kohen, so one has to keep that in mind. If you want to make a so it's not necessarily appropriate to set up a girl who's a Baal Tshuva at a later age, with a kohen. If she became a Baal Tshuva at age 14 or 15 or 16 or whatever, so she probably can still marry a kohen, hopefully. But later in life, it's really not so pushed, so one has to keep that in mind. However, if a woman has relations while she's a nida, then she is still allowed to marry a Kohen, because it's not that it's a forbidden relationship per se. If she had relations with a Jewish person while she was a Nida, she's still allowed to marry a Kohen.
So she was previously married and had an affair.
She's not allowed to marry a Kohen, that's correct. A Jewish woman who was married and she had an affair.
And then her husband dies.
Dies. We're correct. Yeah. So she's now an almana. She's a widow. She's still not allowed to marry a Kohen because she once had relations with a man that she was not permitted to be with at that time. Yosef, that's 100% correct. That's a good point. That is true. Normally, a widow who was remained faithful to her husband, as we hope that the vast majority, if not all, Jewish women will be. So a widow who remained faithful to her husband and never had relations with someone she's not allowed to marry, is still allowed to marry a Kohen. But a Zona, someone that we think of as a Zona, that if she was literally a prostitute, but all her clients were Jewish, then she's still allowed to marry a Kohen. Lamaisa, it's very, it's a little funny. You think that it wouldn't be allowed, and then according to one of the Tanoim, it's not allowed. But according to the accepted halacha, she is in fact allowed to marry a kohen. V'chalola, chalola means that she was the product of a union of a kohen and someone he's not allowed to marry. Like if a kohen marries a divorced woman and they have a daughter, that's called a chalola. That she's not a mamzeres. She's allowed to marry a regular Jew, but she's not allowed to marry a Kohen. He's not allowed to marry a divorced woman. And it's very interesting that the Torah uses here the language, v'isha gerusha me'isha lo yikachu, that a woman who's divorced from her husband, a Kohen shouldn't marry. So why does it say that? Why doesn't it just say isha gerusha? A divorced woman, he shouldn't marry. Why? Does it say Yusha Grusha Meisha? Because I'll learn out from that even if the husband writes a get for his wife, and it says, I divorce you, but you're not allowed to marry anyone else. I divorce you, but you're not allowed to marry anyone else. Is that a kosher get? Who knows? Who wants to venture a guess?
I'll say no.
That is not a kosher get. The get is completely invalid. The couple remains married. But nevertheless, she's not allowed to marry a Kohen, which is very, very interesting. Because she's divorced from her husband. She got a get that said she's divorced from her husband, even though the get explicitly says she's not allowed to marry anyone else, and therefore is not a valid get. So they're not really divorced. Nevertheless, she's not allowed to marry a Kohen.
Even if her husband then dies.
Correct. Even if her husband then dies. Correct. So that's it's an unusual case, but it's an interesting thing to know. The next pasuk Ches, begins v'kidashto, and thou shalt sanctify him. This is referring to the general requirement to give precedence and honor to a Kohen. That's why, when possible, you're supposed to allow a Kohen to lead benching. For when you pass food around the table, for example, you're supposed to pass the platter to a Kohen first so that the Kohen gets to take the choicest piece if he wants. That in all manner of things, one is supposed to treat the Kohen with sanctity and not degrade him in any way. All right, we can skip a little bit about the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol is a very interesting, is even more restrictive in terms of whom he's allowed to marry than a regular Kohen. The Kohen Gadol is required specifically to marry a virgin. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, it says, V'hu isha viv suleha yikach, a woman with her virginity. So, again, a regular Kohen is not required to marry a virgin. He could marry a widow, or he could marry a woman who had premarital relations. Again, not that that's allowed, but a Kohen would still be allowed to marry her if she did it. Again, assuming it was with a Jewish person that she would, in theory, have been allowed to marry. But the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to do that. The Kohen Gadol specifically has to marry a virgin, and specifically, this is this was a sticking point in my Sefer HaChinuch Shir when we were talking about this, that the quintessential virgin, according to Chazal, has to be cannot be a bogeris, a bas mitzvah girl, in other words, over the age of 12 and a half. Meaning, and she can't be a ktana either, she can't be too young. So that means that Chazal tell us that a Kohen Gadol is only allowed to marry a girl between the ages of 12 and 12 and a half. So if the Kohen Gadol is 16, so this isn't such a big age difference. Not that, again, by contemporary standards, we don't allow 12-year-old girls to get married. So this will pose a little bit of a problem. If the Kohen Gadol is appointed when he's 60 and he wants to get married, so it's a little bit of an issue by contemporary standards for him to marry a girl between the ages of 12 and 12 and a half. But luckily, there is a saving grace that if a regular Kohen is already married to someone that he's allowed to be married to, and then he's appointed a Kohen Gadol, he's allowed to stay married to her. He doesn't have to divorce her and now marry a girl between the ages of 12 and 12 and a half. So we hope the Kohen Gadol in the future, when the Meretz Hashem very soon will be a Kohen Gadol, so we assume, we hope, we pray for his wife's health, that if he's appointed when he's 40 or 50, that if his wife dies, then he shouldn't be required to marry a girl between the ages of 12 and 12 and a half. And again, before we're all up in arms, we have to remember that a lot of these things are societally determined. That nowadays we completely look askance at such an idea, but in other societies, very large age differences and very young girls getting married was not at all viewed as problematic. I know I mentioned that I went out with a girl whose ancestors were from Tunisia, so she told me that when her grandparents got married, probably another Sephardi I went out with, I think, told me the same thing, would be happy in Ashkenazi. That when her grandparents got married, her grandmother was 14 and her grandfather was 45. They were happily married, probably not for that many years. But different societies have different standards about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. The next thing the Parsha talks about is, again, starting in verse 17. Sorry, 16. Talking about the mumin, that when a Kohen has certain defects in his body, then he's not allowed to perform the avoda in the Beis Hamikdash. That if hands or legs are broken, or certain defects in the eye, then he's not allowed to perform the avoda in the Beis Hamikdash. That's why the Sefer HaChinuch explains, remember we were learning about it for those who were in my shir at the time, that it's not that we're discriminating against people who have less than perfect physiques, but rather that when people come into the Beis HaMikdash and they see the worship being performed, that people have to have the appropriate awe. That, like it or not, it's human nature that when people have certain defects, they are not as awed by the situation. So therefore, we have to ensure that the Kohanim be of the highest physical caliber. And the same thing applies to Korbanos, that's starting in chapter 22 of Leviticus. The Torah discusses blemishes that an animal is not allowed to have if it's going to be offered as a korban in the Beis HaMikdash. And Chazal point out there are certain things that are blemishes for people and not blemishes for animals, meaning the Kohen is not allowed to worship if he has such a blemish, but an animal would be allowed to be sacrificed if it has a similar blemish. There are things that are blemishes for animals and would not be a blemish for a Kohen worshiping in the Beis HaMikdash. And what's my favorite example of a blemish that disqualifies an animal as a korban but does not disqualify a person to be a Kohen serving in the Beis HaMikdash? Who remembers from my shir? Very funny. Someone wrote two legs. Yes, correct. An animal with two legs, yes, it cannot be brought as a korban, but a person with two legs can be brought. It can serve as a basic English. My favorite blemish of this nature is a C-section. A C-section. If an animal is born by C-section, it cannot be offered as a korban. But if a kohen is born by C-section, he is allowed to worship in the Beis HaMikdash. Very interesting, because it says by the animals, ki yivaled, that an animal, it says Vayter in the Parsha, shoro chesed oez ki yivaled, when it shall be born. So born, we assume, means the natural way, unless it tells you otherwise. So, in other words, an animal that's born by C-section, it's almost like it's not really considered an animal, because it was never born. It's not considered being born if it's if it doesn't come out the natural way. It's like a fake animal. But a person, even if a person is born by C-section, a person is not a fake person. So therefore, even though he didn't come out the natural way, so therefore, it is not allowed for a Kohen who was born by C-section to worship in the Beis HaMikdash. When it describes the mumen, the blemishes that affect korbanos, the animals that rise of korbanos, one thing that it singles out is defects in the reproductive organs. So if you look at Perek Chaf Beis, chapter 22, verse Chaf Dalet, verse 24, that you're not allowed to offer up a korban whose genitals were crushed or torn or various verbs of that nature. So the key words in this parsha that cause a lot of discussion is uva'artzichem lo sasu, and in your land you shall not do. So what do you mean? What does that have to do with anything? First it says, an animal with crushed organs cannot be brought as a korban, and in your land, you shall not do. Seems like a non sequitur. What are you talking about? I hear rustling of pages. That means someone wants to give an answer? It means that you're not allowed to inflict these wounds on either people or animals. That it's strictly forbidden. There is a rule called sirus that one is not allowed to cause any damage or defect on for any reason other than pikuach nefesh, obviously. We're not allowed to cause any damage to reproductive organs of animals and certainly of humans either. That means that a Jewish surgeon, urologist, is not allowed to perform a vasectomy. That means that a Jewish veterinarian is not allowed to neuter animals. So this is actually a sticking point. I remember hearing a story that there was a veterinarian who wanted to convert to Judaism. She wanted to become a Gioris. So the Beis Din said no, that she cannot become a Gioris because the main parnasa, the main way that veterinarians actually make money is by neutering animals. And I mean, if she had completely renounced her being a vet or, you know, made some sort of arrangement where she wouldn't have to do it, again, it's probably be unlikely, then she would be allowed to convert. But if she, you know, the Beis Din knows in advance that she's planning not to observe all the mitzvos, then you have a problem. Then that conversion would not be, that would be a very problematic conversion, potentially completely invalid even after the fact. That's why if a vet wants to convert, they have to be pretty well investigated. But this prohibition comes into play when people want to have permanent birth control. This conversation comes into play, rather. That there is also a shaila about how much this applies to women. So there's a machlokes as to whether this prohibition midoraisa applies only to men or applies to women as well. Everybody agrees that one is not allowed to destroy a woman's reproductive organs, but the question is, how severe the prohibition is in regards to men. So if, for example, you know, a woman decided she doesn't want to have any more kids and she wants to have her fallopian tubes tied, then it's very questionable whether that is permissible. It's probably not not permissible at all. And the only methods that would be available would be regular birth control methods that would be permitted in situations where birth control is permissible. So again, that's you know, that one's not allowed to do that if you have a pet. It's not so pushy. There are rules about how to deal with pets, and regarding it might be a difference between male pets and female pets, and non-Jewish vet and a Jewish vet. Non-Jewish vets are not really allowed to do serus, to damage reproductive organs, but there may be more leeway there. So just to scratch the surface over here to get people aware that there are issues about this topic, and I think we'll stop here for tonight. The rest of the parsha mostly talks about the holidays. So we talk about holidays usually when the holiday, the individual holiday is coming up. So we don't necessarily go through every holiday now. Talks about Sfiras Omer, which we talked about a couple weeks ago. So obviously there's much, much more to learn from this parsha, but we just scratched the surface of a few mitzvos that are mentioned at the beginning of this parsha that we don't always have much opportunity to talk about, because they're not part of daily Jewish life. I'll stay on for a minute in case anyone has any further questions or comments. Otherwise, I wish everyone to stay healthy and safe. I wish everyone a good Shabbos and hope to see you again next week. If anyone wants to sign off, feel free to sign off. But if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to take them now.
Thank you.
Okay. Good Shabbos. Good to see everyone.
Shabbos.